Do you remember what it was like when you got your first Walkman? You remember that feeling? When you got a first Walkman in your hand, it was like, wow. Well, I haven't picked up any MP3 player that has made me go, wow, okay, I want to carry this wherever I go. This is the first thing that makes me feel, wow, okay. Everyone's going to want to have one of these.
The best 30 plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Irfan Elijah. Joining me today, his upcoming spoken word album, Leander Caney Whispers His Favorite Coldplay Songs to You, is sure to please you ASMR folks. The star of the new album, Leander Caney, is here.
Hello, Irfan.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Hello, Irfan.
I'm going to light some candles, put on some incense, listen to that. It's going to be very erotic. Also joining us, probably from a airport tarmac, maybe a school of drumming, David Pierini is here.
Irfan, how you doing?
Hey, dude. You will not believe how many tweets I got last week about where you were recording from. Where were you recording from last week?
Well, we thought it would sound better if we said an Olive Garden, but I was actually at a coffee shop.
Yeah, I thought you were in the like the area of the restaurant where the bussers come and like dump all their dishes.
Glasses breaking on the floor. Yeah.
I learned my lesson. The loudest coffee shop I've ever heard.
You know, I'm a relative virgin when it comes to podcasting, so
and you know, the thing is, we probably should have mentioned last week where you were. I don't think we actually ever mentioned it. So it's like all of a sudden people are listening, and it sounds like someone's broadcasting from the dining area of their local Olive Garden. And there's like blenders going off and stuff. So David has learned his lesson.
So what you're saying is the tweets were not favorable.
People were humorous about it. No one got extremely irate about the situation. But they professed their desire for you to record from a maybe a library or from a Buddhist monk temple, maybe someplace with some more silence.
Nuclear bunker.
Yeah, nuclear bunker would also be fine. Someplace with fewer people clanging their dishes. So we've got you,
Leander.
In
it's funny you mention nuclear bunker, because the apartment building that I currently reside in was built in 1951 as a fallout shelter.
Really?
Yes.
Really? You live in a fallout shelter?
I do, yep. Cement walls, big steel fire doors.
What?
Very exciting.
150 feet underground?
Well, actually, I'm on the second floor, but you know, no, it's just it's a big cement building that they built in case of a nuclear event of some kind.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Well, that would explain why you're so pale.
Yeah, right.
Not
I'm
getting enough air.
I've actually never seen you in person, so I'm just guessing that you're very pale.
Oh, you guessed correctly.
I mean, you also are in Minnesota, which doesn't get a lot of sun, do they?
No, not today especially. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have got all sorts of tasty tidbits to talk about. We're going to cover this week's best Apple news. And if you stick around until the end, we're doing a new segment that I am calling the Lust List. This is actually repurposed from Cult of Mac, Leander, the Lust List. And I thought it'd be cool. We always talk about technology that we are reviewing or that we've used, and that's great. But I wanted to hear about technology or gadgets or whatever, something that you really want that you don't have yet. So we'll do that at the end of the episode. Stick around for that. Also, David is going to be sharing some more weird and wacky stories from the Cult of Mac. Before we jump into the news, Leander, would you like to say a word about your favorite bear?
I would.
<I'd laughs> Who likes to burrow?
he loves to burrow. He loves to tunnel. We got to say thanks so much to Tunnel Bear for sponsoring this episode of the Cultcast. And Tunnel Bear is a super easy to use, super secure, and really, really fast VPN that you can get at gettunnelbear.com.
Gettunnelbear.com. I also want to thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode. Let me ask you entrepreneurs a question, those of you with your own small businesses. If you started this minute, how much time would it take for you to catch up on all your client invoices, to organize all your receipts, to figure out which clients owe you what and when. If that idea gives you extreme gas and makes you feel overwhelmed, you need to give FreshBooks a try.
Yeah, I'm getting gassy just thinking about it. Yeah.
FreshBooks is dead simple cloud accounting software made for entrepreneurs, small business owners who want to take the work out of managing their paperwork. There are over 5 million people using FreshBooks right now to effortlessly create invoices and send invoices. There's no formatting. There's no formulas or fuss. You can snap photos of your receipts using your phone and watch FreshBooks manage your expenses for you. You can set FreshBooks up to import your expenses directly from your bank, so the next time you use your debit card or credit card for a meal or a tank of gas, it's instantly recorded in FreshBooks for you. All of this, I can speak from experience, saves you a ton of time, and you will have that feeling of zen at tax time where you don't have to scramble to get everything ready like you did probably in April, because you'll be ready. And FreshBooks gives you access to all these great reports, so you can always go and look to see exactly where your business is at. You can get a 30-day free trial at FreshBooks.com/cultcast. If you haven't tried it out yet, you could try everything they have to offer. Their beautiful iOS app included. That's FreshBooks.com/cultcast. Please enter cultcast in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Thank you to FreshBooks for supporting yet another episode. Okay, let's start with this. I just wanted to point this out because truly, we live in an age of wonder. You guys aren't big Periscope users, I'm assuming. I'm guessing David's not.
No.
Okay. Leander, have you ever used Periscope?
I haven't, no. And I don't think anyone... Yeah, no, I haven't.
Okay, so it's essentially a live streaming app that lives on your iPhone, and you can do stuff live. You can stream yourself. You can write on the screen. They've made an update to Periscope that allows you to do live drone flights. So if you have a DJI drone, you can hook it up to the Periscope app in iOS, and you can literally fly around in the sky and broadcast it to people all over the world. Now, for those of you listening, you're probably not all that impressed by this technology. And I wasn't really either until I got to thinking. It's 2016, okay? In 1903, so about 100 years ago, the Wright brothers flew the airplane for the first time. So 100 years ago, they had just discovered how to fly an airplane. In 1907, the Model T was created, the first mass-produced car ever, and it would eventually go on to become affordable to the masses. So it was the first car that people could actually afford. That was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, people were still riding around on horses. And now, in your underpants, you can sit in your living room and watch someone fly a miniature helicopter around remotely and watch it fly over the landscapes of the world. Is that not one of the most incredible things that you can think of? Is no one else impressed by that?
Well, yeah, it's pretty miraculous, but I don't know about going back 100 years. I mean, you only got to go back a few, you know, like a decade, and that would have been unimaginable.
Yes,
that's 100 years ago. Like, well, I was watching, you know, some Caesar, we adopted the puppies. I've been watching Cesar Romano videos recently, and he does a lot of like video Skyping on his iPad.
Yeah.
That I think is kind of miraculous. He's sitting in the back of a car and he's like talking to, you know, Jerry Seinfeld or somebody, and it's a video call. That seems to me completely nutly Jetsons, you know, 10 years ago. That was completely unimaginable. Now it's completely commonplace.
I mean, in the 90s, if you wanted to get on the internet, you had to listen to this sound for like 10 or 15 seconds. And 15 seconds later, you'd be able to access the internet on AOL and browse, and a website would take like 20 seconds to load.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Truly.
Broadcasting was impossible. Do you remember Apple had all those problems up until just a few years ago with, you know, broadcasting its...
That's
notes.
A good point. Yeah, not even Apple could do it.
Because it takes gigantic infrastructure. You know, you've really got to have a really, really huge, huge infrastructure. And that's what Twitter's bringing to this, right? You know, with being able to broadcast like from a drone.
Yeah, you could broadcast from a drone, and anyone with an iPhone, anyone with Periscope can watch it. You can watch this stuff on your Apple TV now. I think that's pretty cool, especially once people start using this technology. I mean, imagine being able to sit on your couch and watch someone in Rome fly a drone over the city. It's like a helicopter tour. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I just wanted to start with that because I was like, truly, we live in an amazing time.
Do you have a drone?
I do not have a drone.
Do you,
although
Dave?
I would love...
I do not. I bought my brother one for Christmas, though, and he loves his.
Which one did you get him?
Oh, my gosh. I cannot remember. It was something I got out with a Groupon, so it was cheap.
Okay. It was like one of those little tiny drones.
The back of a truck, in other words, right?
Yeah, right. No, this is big enough, though, to attach a GoPro camera, and he had just got a GoPro for himself. And so I bought him this little drone, and he flies it around in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Taking landscape footage of Green Bay, Wisconsin?
Yeah, yeah. That's the cheese making and the Packers, all that good stuff.
Behind the scenes cheese making from the top of the factory. That's
it's not pretty, let me tell you.
No one wants to know how the cheese is made. You just want to eat the cheese.
Exactly.
You don't want to know how the sausage is made either. Let's move on to this news this week. Of iTunes being, I guess not closed down, but there was a rumor that Apple was going to stop letting people download music from iTunes. So, you know, you buy an album, download it. And citing sources with close and active business relationships with Apple, Digital Music News said Apple allegedly had an aggressive plan to terminate music downloads from iTunes within 2 years. Their sources say, "Keeping iTunes music downloads running forever," and I'm quoting here, "isn't really on the table anymore." They ran this by Apple rep Tom Neumayer, and this was Recode, reached out to him for comments. He said the report was, quote-unquote, not true. But that's totally what he would say if it were, quote-unquote, totally true. Wouldn't it, right? I mean, that's exactly what he would say. But yeah. Apple's iTunes business continues to bring in hundreds of millions of dollars each year, but it is in decline due to the rise of music streaming services, which I find this whole thing so strange because I remember like 10 years ago, I had a Creative MP3 player, and there were services that would lease you music, and that was my primary way of listening to music at that time. It works just like how Spotify does today, where you could download an album, and if you quit paying for the service, then eventually the music expires and you don't get to listen to it anymore. Now it's popular again. My question to you, Leander, do you think there's any chance that Apple would ever stop selling music on iTunes?
Yeah,
this,
yeah,
to
totally,
me, this
yeah.
doesn't make any sense. Why would they stop?
Oh, I don't know. If you know, they had some interesting numbers, downloads are in really sharp decline. I mean, they were at their highest in 2012 when it was 3.9 billion.
Wow.
There were millions of songs being downloaded, and it's been on a slow, you know, decline since then. And even though streaming, you know, is still a fraction of that, it's going to be picking up. And they had some analysts in that report, you know, projecting that by 2020, it's going to be 10 times the size of downloads. And it's already kind of confusing, you know, like it was like, you know, iTunes is already a gigantic bloated blob of a nightmare of, you know,
yeah.
And I got confused the other day, too. I was trying to stream a song and I ended up in the downloading part of my phone. And I was like, where am I? You know, what's going on here? And it took me a little while to figure it out, like, you know, where to get back to. I haven't downloaded a song for a long time. I mean, you know, and that part of the business is definitely in decline. And Apple's, you know, I mean, they've always been pretty ruthless about ditching old, you know, cannibalizing their own devices, their own businesses, and moving on to the next thing. So I thought it was kind of credible.
But why? I guess my thought is there's always going to be people that want to download and own their music, right? I don't think that's ever going to go away.
Yeah, you know, I guess, but...
So why get rid of it? I mean, does it cost Apple that much to run that side of the business? They clearly have the infrastructure in place already. Why not just keep it around forever and let people who want to own their music own it and let everyone else stream stuff for free? I don't understand why they have to be mutually exclusive.
You know, maybe so. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the licensing as well. You know, I mean, I'm just, maybe the record companies don't want to do that anymore. You know, they can't sell and resell you your music if you've downloaded it and you own it, if you own the file.
That's true.
That's a bit cynical. But I don't know. You know, like, I don't know if people want to own music anymore. You know, the new Radiohead album just came out this weekend. I mean, I didn't even think about downloading it because I can stream it.
But there are still a lot of albums that are not available right away for streaming because artists don't make very much money from streaming. In fact, your favorite band, Coldplay, oftentimes when they release a record, it's not available on Spotify for weeks or months because they want guys like you to go out there and buy several copies and not stream it because they don't make a dime, you know, on, well, that's an over-exaggeration. They make almost nothing on streaming music.
not right now, but you know, I think it's, the music industry is in flux, isn't it? It's changing. So, you know, what's true now, I mean, I don't think it's going to be true in a few years. I think, you know, the revenues are really shifting. I mean, the estimates were that streaming is going to be worth, you know, $3.9 billion or $4 billion, whatever iTunes was in 2012 at the height of music downloads. So I think it has the potential, you know, to be even bigger, to be an even bigger revenue stream than downloading ever was at its height.
Because you think that more people will stream, and even though the streaming pays less per play, because more people are using it, the artists will end up making more. Is that your?
Yeah, it's you know, that is going to become the model for the music industry in the digital age. It's going to be streaming and the revenue, and you know, as long as money continues to pour into the music industry, which, you know, that of course is debatable, but. These estimates that these analysts are putting out is that they think that streaming will become, you know, the biggest source of revenue for the recorded music industry.
Well, I think it will become the biggest source of revenue for, like, the labels. I kind of wonder if the artists are going to see any of that money. Because right now, I forget, wasn't it like Taylor Swift, like one of her really popular songs was streamed some unbelievable amount. I'm going to make up a number. It was 250 Googleplex. Right. It's not like a number with like 100 zeros after it. And she made, I think, approximately $300.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it was so bad that she pulled all her music from Spotify. Yeah. Because she said that she just wasn't making any money from streaming music. And if Taylor Swift can't make money in high volume, I mean, how is an artist who's just starting going to make any money?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I know. It's tough. But, you know, like I said, I think a lot of it has to do with it being sort of, you know, a new nascent service, and it hasn't really taken off. The number of subscribers are still relatively small. But, you know, we're seeing this switch. You're going from downloading music to streaming it.
Yeah. David, do you stream music?
I do. I use Spotify, but I don't subscribe to it, so I just take the free stuff, and every 30 minutes I get hit with watching a video or a couple of ads. And I was sort of wondering, Leander, do you see a time where all these streaming services that offer a free service, if that's going to end and it's all going to be subscription based and you pay a monthly fee, and there may still be advertising on that as a way to maybe bring more royalties to the artists?
I can't see that going away. You know, I think streaming is the new radio, and it'll become much more like, you know, FM radio. You know, I wonder whether FM radio is going to still be around, or at least, you know, like over the airways. I mean, you can see that becoming digitized. You know, I don't know. There are a lot of different scenarios. I mean, I don't want to. I was reading the other day that the only growing format in the music industry, guess what it is?
Streaming.
Vinyl.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Streaming is growing too, but the only physical format, yeah, vinyl. Vinyl's making a comeback. But the weird thing is that 50% of people who buy vinyl records don't even play them. they just keep them on a shelf.
They
don't even have a record
that.
Player. Yeah,
they don't have time to listen to the records. They're too busy waxing their mustaches.
Well, and you know, trying to sit on these things as collector's pieces items.
Do you know who one of the biggest retailers of vinyl is in the U.S.?
I bet it's like Urban Outfitters or something.
It is. It's Urban Outfitters. Huh. Isn't that amazing? Good guess. Yeah. Good guess. Yeah. It's like, where else do the hipsters shop? I actually love Urban Outfitters. But yeah, if they're not the largest, they're one of the largest places to buy.
Well, where can you buy
vinyl
records anymore? You know, Tower Records has gone away. This town used to be lousy with record stores. But I think, you know, they're down in single digits now. And they're definitely, yeah, they're super specialist. I mean, you know.
And they're expensive, too.
I haven't touched a record for years.
They just sit on your shelf making you feel cool?
No, I got, you know, my friends stole them from me, so.
Let's move on. Let's talk about the App Store. Some interesting facts and figures about the App Store came out recently, and I really couldn't believe these stats about the App Store regarding who's making money in the App Store itself. Because how many apps are or how many apps are sold? How many are in the App Store? Do you have any idea, Leander? Maybe like 2 million?
I'm not sure it's two. I would have guessed at one, but I haven't looked at the number recently. But it's between 1 and 2 million, I think, individual apps.
So here's some staggering figures for you guys. 95 or 94% of App Store revenue goes to just 1% of publishers. So 1% of all the publishers.
Just like the U.S. economy.
Yeah. Isn't that strange? That is a very strange parallel. I thought
Bernie Sanders,
same thing.
Bernie Sanders, yeah, we should get him in charge of the App Store. He'd change things up.
That's right. He is, so if you sell an app that's popular, he's just going to take your revenue and give it to the guy with the fart app. So this information, according to Sensor Tower, they also found that about $1.34 billion of the estimated $1.43 billion in net revenue generated went to just 623 publishers. That means the other 61,677 publishers had to share the remaining 6% of the revenue, which was approximately $85 million. If divided equally, those 61,000 publishers have made less than $1,400 each.
Well, the numbers are really shocking if they're true. You know, 94% of the revenue just goes to like 1% of all the publishers.
Yeah.
That's bananas. I mean, I didn't really dig into that. You know, they had a description of the methodology, and it was talking about, you know, they excluded all of the apps that make money outside of the App Store, and like right. Amazon. You know, I mean, Amazon is obviously like, you know, they make their money through Amazon's, you know, Amazon site, Amazon services, and Uber and a million others. You know, so there's a whole bunch of apps that don't, they aren't doing in-app purchases or aren't getting revenue directly from sales on the App Store. And so the list was all these game makers, wasn't it? You know, the Candy Crush and the Clash of Clans folks and all these different games. I mean, it was almost dominated almost completely by games, right? The list.
Yeah, games make a lot of the money, especially with in-app purchases. I was just surprised that the concentration was so small on one subset of publishers.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably very hard to make a good app. It's probably easy to make an app, hard to make a good app. So the guys with the talents are being rewarded.
It's hard to get any attention. You know, like this. I think this. You know, the long tail thing really isn't working, and is just not you know, viable. Although, having said that, you know, I was trying to think. There's a whole bunch of independent publishers that do make a pretty good living. Like, you know, Readly, it wasn't on that list, and they're that Ukrainian software maker that makes Scanner Pro.
Oh, I didn't realize
the Spark email app. Uh-huh. You know, they've got some of the. I think they have a suite of, I think, 6 to 8 apps, and they're always at the top of the sort of business productivity charts. And they're doing really well. I mean, they are really killing it as a company. And you know, so they're not showing up on this, but they're still making a fairly decent living through the App Store. And I think there's, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen any numbers about smaller independent publishers. But, you know, I would hazard a guess that there were, you know, it's as healthy as the old shareware model was, or that, you know, in days of yore when you had to download software onto your computer. I would just hazard that guess, but it's definitely not the lottery. You know, it's definitely, you can't get rich like you could in the early days. A lot of it has to do with, you know, discoverability, I think.
I think you're right. And I think that kind of is the problem with the App Store. And it's been a problem for ever since the App Store has existed. And Apple keeps buying these companies to help fix the problem. And yet, I don't feel like discovery in the App Store has ever gotten any better.
Yeah, well, you know, smart search and, you know, looking at what you've downloaded and recommending stuff to you or whatever, you know. I mean, none of that stuff kind of really does function, does it? It's like getting people's attention. It's like a marketing problem, really. And you have to have a lot of money to advertise.
Yeah, there's just too many apps jostling for your attention. Exactly. Let's talk about Siri for a moment. Did you guys see the new Siri replacement that came out this week?
No.
I did not.
Did you see? You didn't see Viv? Okay.
I saw some stories about it. I haven't checked it out.
That's good enough. You don't need to know a lot about this to have a discussion here. So the guys who created Siri came out with a new version of Siri called Viv. This is not something that Apple is going to be adopting to the iPhones, in case you were curious, or the iPads, what have you. Because these guys have a new company now. They have left Apple. They're doing their own thing. And they basically sold Siri to Apple and have created something new. And they were giving examples of what Viv can do. And some of it was really impressive. For instance, he would be asking these really complex questions. He would say, Viv, is it going to be sunny tomorrow at the Golden Gate Bridge after 5 p.m.? And then Viv would think for a moment and then give the best answer it could. And he started giving these examples about all the cool, complex things that Viv could do, such as, you could order flowers very easily. He would say, Viv, I want to order flowers for my mom for Mother's Day. And it would pop up, you know, all these different flower selections from one of the selected vendors. And you could just say, yep, those are the ones I want. And the deal was done. It would charge your card. It knew your mom's address from your address book. And it would send her flowers. And he gave one example of this after another. And as he was giving these examples, he was getting really excited. And he was like, isn't this amazing? Look how cool this is. And I started getting really annoyed. I was getting genuinely frustrated watching these examples, because I kept thinking to myself, a lot of these interactions that he's having with Viv, the new Siri replacements, they kind of demonstrate to me that maybe there's a problem in voice communication with these devices. And I got to thinking, I don't know if voice communication is ever going to be a popular thing, because you're corralled into having these discussions with a computer and the interactions are limited, you know, especially in commerce situations. So if you want to order flowers for your mom on the internet, you could go and search different sites, find the exact flowers that you wanted, and you could, you know, get the best price. Well, with voice search, I find it to be very problematic for discovery. Have you guys found that to be true? Like when you're looking for things, when you're searching for things with voice, it's hard to know what you're searching for without being presented a lot of visual options. Do you guys have that same issue?
I can speak to that. I mean, everything from searching for a store, getting directions, putting in an address, you know, Siri's batting average is probably like 400. At best for me.
Now, I'm not a baseball guy. Is that good or bad?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Well, that's pretty good for a baseball player, but for a computer, no.
Okay.
You know, you want it to bat 1,000. You want it to get it right every time.
Yes. Okay. So 1,000 would be a perfect score.
Yeah.
Okay. I got to brush up on my baseball analogies. Forgive me. So you're having issues with Siri as well. I guess. Looking at it from farther back, it's not even does Siri understand what you're saying, does Viv understand what you're saying, it's the computer making decisions on what to even show you. So like he would show an example of trying to order a hotel room, and it would bring up hotels.com, and so I was getting frustrated because I'm like, these aren't examples that I would find to be useful in real life. The internet offers you an unlimited amount of choices, but these voice searches constantly railroad you into using their voice partner. So if you do a search on Siri, Siri might look to Wolfram Alpha to give you an answer. Whereas if you were just doing a text search on the internet, you would have that at your disposal, but you would have a limitless amount of other sites and information available for you to make your choice. And I don't like being limited in my options when I'm doing voice search to just the apps that are compatible with voice search. Am I making sense here, or are you guys just not following me?
Absolutely.
Did you read that, oh my goodness me, the feature about it that was talking about, the reporter from, I think the Washington Post did the story about, you know, he got a tour of Viv. And there was some interesting stuff in there, because these guys were the guys that were working at Siri when it was sold to Apple. And so they had these meetings with Steve Jobs. And the precursor to Siri was an open platform. Apparently, you know, it was plugged into a whole bunch of different services. Do you remember you could download an app to use it? And
I do remember, yeah, before they built it into iOS.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so you could, and it was connected to like OpenTable and I don't know, dozens of different services. I can't remember the list of them now, but there was dozens and dozens of different things you could do with it. And Jobs, you know, really pared it back. And they weren't clear exactly, you know, what happened, but it looks as though Jobs, you know, tried to make it very, very limited in what it could do. It was just connected to just a few services and could do just a few things. And presumably, you know, it would do just a few things well instead of being broader. And this is what they're hoping now with Viv. They want to open it up into this open platform where anybody can plug in their services into its API, and you'll be able to query it to do, you know, a whole bunch of different things. They think it's, you know, far enough along to be able to do that. We'll see. But, you know, that's the thing. It's, you know, that if they're building an open platform that will plug into, you know, almost anything, if all these app makers and all these different services could, like, plug into this thing, that sounds great, right? It's almost exactly the same as equivalent to Google, I guess.
Yes, it isn't, because Google, I mean, you're able to parse through visual information very quickly. So if I were to show you a list of different Coldplay songs that you love, Leander, you'd very quickly be able to say, oh, that's the song I want to play, and you would play it. But if you were talking to Viv and you wanted to play an album, and you're like, I don't even know the names of the songs on this album, right? Who knows the names of the songs like? I don't.
Well,
I don't even know what the names of the albums are half the time.
Right.
So it creates this problem where you don't – where when it comes to discovery, it's hard to figure out what you're even trying to do because you don't have that visual element.
Well, it reminds me of, you know, like – and you remember in the old days, like Price Grabber and a bunch of other like sort of shopping services, they promised to find you the best price, and it quickly became kind of apparent that they would like – you know, you would get the best price from the limited number of partners that they worked
with. Exactly. Yes.
So you were like, I don't really believe this. But, you know, in a lot of situations that you're using intelligent assistant, you know, like Siri or Viv, is when you don't want to have a whole plethora of options, right? You want to do something kind of specific. You want to find directions to a certain place. You want to say, oh, well, you know, Google recommends you go this way, but on these roads, you know, take this highway. But, you know, Siri says, all right, no, you should take these roads. I mean, you don't want to be presented with different choices. You want something, you know, quite specific. Play a certain song, you know. I think for a lot of the scenarios where you want to use the personal assistant, you don't want to have all those choices.
That's very true. And I think that's why I was getting frustrated, because he's trying to use Viv to do things that I would never want to do because they weren't specific enough, you know? Like if you're trying to play a song off an album or something and you know exactly what you want, well then okay, it's using voice is fine. But when you're unsure exactly what you're trying to do, there's a discovery process that happens during search, especially on Google, where you're looking at all these different visual elements. And I don't know if voice is ever going to be useful in that capacity, which makes me really think about its overall utility. I wonder, I mean, I have this Echo now.
Yeah. You're not really convinced about it, right?
And I'm not convinced. Yeah. I mean, I like it. And for certain things, it's a fabulous tea timer. I'll tell you that much right now. If you're making tea, using the Echo is great, because setting timers is really easy to do. But yeah, for a lot of things, I'm just confused on how I should be interacting with it and what it can do for me. And if I don't know exactly what I'm trying to do, I find the experience to be frustrating. Perfect example, if I am trying to listen to a podcast, the Echo will railroad me into using its preferred podcast provider. And I don't like that.
Railroad.
It's because it has a business relationship with, I don't even know who they use. And so you have to, you know, pull a podcast down from this service that you're not familiar with, that doesn't sync with your phone. At least I haven't figured out how to make that happen yet. And so it ends up being frustrating, because I'm like, where is this information coming from? I don't feel like I can control it in any way. So I just don't know if voice is ever going to be a thing that replaces visual search, or if we're going to have those computers from the future and interact with them the way we see in movies, where like they do everything for us. Yeah. You know what I mean? I don't know if we're ever going to get there.
I don't know.
Unless I have my VR headset on.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I had the opposite. You know, I had a great. You know, I was using Alexa all weekend to play. To play Radiohead.
Yeah, Radiohead. Right. Wink, wink. Sure.
All weekend.
Actually, as long as you're mentioning Radiohead, I think somebody on Twitter wanted to know what your thoughts were on that album. So,
yeah,
Leander's mini review.
It's great. I think it's absolutely awesome. Yeah, I was. I've been playing. Even my son was sick of it. Burn the Witch, you know, the single, it was on constant replay. That's the one thing I couldn't get it to do, is like play it over and over again. Like I couldn't get it to repeat. If I could have got it on like constant rotation, even my son was complaining, oh no, not this again. And
you couldn't get it to repeat on your Echo?
Well, and I couldn't figure out how to do it, so I had to keep on it every time when the song stopped.
See, that is a perfect illustration of what I'm talking about. You're trying to do something simple, like repeat a song on a visual experience. It would be very easy to do. And maybe we're missing the infrastructure. We haven't grown up with this voice control infrastructure that maybe you would.
If but come on, this is early days yet. It's been like what? It's only been a year or two since Siri's been around, and then only how long for Alexa, which is like the first one that's really, 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 really good.
But I need to do a full review of the Echo. There are many things about the Echo that I do like. As far as the voice recognition is unbelievable. There is probably 40 feet from me to the Echo. I have two walls between me and the Echo, and I can speak at a normal volume and ask it a question. And virtually every single time it understands me, it perks right up, understands exactly what I'm saying, and does what I'm asking it to do. I have never seen a voice-controlled piece of technology as accurate or as sensitive as this one is. It's way better than Siri in that regard.
Yeah, it's super sensitive. I had the music blaring, and I was at the other end of the house, and I mentioned it, and it stopped.
Can talk to it even when there's noise happening in your room, and it still is able to discern your voice.
Yeah, it was freaky, actually. I was like, hey, there's no way. Because if it was a human, they couldn't have heard that, but the machine did. It was really strange.
I heard you, Leander. What? Huh? Did you say something, Echo?
Yeah.
No. Okay, let's move on to... David, you want to do some stories from the Cult of Mac, right?
Would be glad to, sure.
Okay, before we do that, though, Leander, tell us some more about Tunnel Bear, would you?
Tunnel Bear, yep, the easiest to use VPN you'll ever lay your little sweaty hands on. It's... So easy to use.
My hands are dry. Thank you very much.
Easy to use. My mom uses it to tunnel to the UK to watch UK TV, and it works on all your devices. So it works on her iPad, her iPhone, and she's sits in front of her TV, and she uses AirPlay to watch it on her TV. You know, coming through her iPad. It's absolutely superb. Really fast. Really easy to use. And Cult of Cast listeners can get a free trial by going to gettunnelbear.com. Gettunnelbear.com, and it's a free trial. You can check it out, kick the tires, and see how you like it. And it's very, very reasonable, very, very cheap. And I buy it. My brother buys it. We've all been users for a long time. My mom buys it, so I highly recommend it.
And you were saying it's especially useful if you are trying to play, like, stream video and stuff from a region that you don't live in. Because you can, you know, act as though you were living in that region with Tunnel Bear, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly how it works. You know, it's a virtual private network. It's a private tunnel to, another country, another region. So it supports dozens of countries. You can surf the web. If you live in China, you can surf the web as though you're in the US or the UK. If you live in the US, you can surf the web as though you live in Sweden or Spain or Germany or... anywhere in Asia, any kind of country. So it gives you a local IP address. You can access services that aren't available in your geolocation. So it's especially useful for people who live outside of the U.S. You know, you can get prices in dollars. You can stream from Netflix and other streaming services as though you live right here in the U.S. So it's great.
You can
for
finally watch
stuff.
those romantic Spanish soap operas that you love, Leander.
Right.
¿Por qué?
Yeah.
Me gusta sus zapatos.
Yep, it's super easy, super reliable, very, very fast, great encryption. It's very secure. Absolutely a must-have if you are using any kind of public hotspot. If you're surfing the web in a coffee shop or at a hotel at an airport, it's crazy not to use a VPN because you never know who you're connecting to and who could be snooping all over your traffic. So it's definitely a must-have.
Fantastic. So that is gettunnelbear.com. Gettunnelbear.com. Thanks to Tunnel Bear for supporting this episode. All right, David.
Yes.
Are you ready to talk about more stories?
Oh, yes.
From the Cult of Mac. What do you got in store for us this week?
Well, I had to tell you about a post that we had published just today. We're starting to do a series of posts on the art world's reaction to the passing of Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I'm taking a look at the different pieces of art from tattoos to sculpture to operas, all inspired by Steve Jobs. And today we've got an artist by the name of Bradley Hart from New York City. Actually, he was born in Toronto, but he works in New York City now. And he injects bubble wrap. He injects paint into bubble wrap to create these kind of pixely looking portraits of people. And he did one of Steve Jobs. And what he's got.
You said this post is up on Cult of Mac right now?
that's on Cult of Mac right now. You can actually see how he does this work. I've got a little video at the bottom of the post. And it's just really interesting. He's got sort of this mathematical equation for mapping out his colors and what color goes where to make, like, why. And he did this amazing 4x5 piece of jobs. And another interesting aspect of this is that he fills up each bubble to the point where the paint leaks out the back, and it creates a second piece of art, kind of a smeary, impressionistic thing. So you actually get two one-of-a-kind pieces from one art project.
I'm looking at this right now. This is really, it looks like 8-bit, like, pixel artwork.
Yeah, and that it's photorealistic, isn't it? And it reminds me of magazine printing, you know, where you can see the dots.
The dot matrix, yeah.
You don't want to be blundering around the museum and blunder into that, do you? End up covered in paint.
Well, he says that paint eventually hardens, and that should last longer than any JPEG picture. So, well, remains to be seen. But he kind of likes playing with the idea of bubble wrap is this thing that we can't help ourselves. We just feel the urge to start popping the bubbles. But yet art is not something we're allowed to touch. So he's kind of messing with our minds a little bit.
Well, let me ask you, you also posted a piece about the price of old Apple technology being sold on eBay.
Yeah.
And I found this to be crazy because you had mentioned, especially iPods. You were talking about one guy who had like a collection of iPods, and most of them were still brand new in the shrink wrap.
In the box, never seen the light of day.
Those things are going to be insanely valuable one day. I sold a used iPod Classic years ago for almost as much as I had bought it for, because they are, some of them at least, they seem to be appreciating in value, right?
Especially if they are still in the box and still wrapped. Well, I mean,
yeah, tell us some of the prices, Dave. What did that one sell for?
Some of the prices are truly out of this world. Like, people won't believe this.
Yeah, there's a guy in Canada right now on eBay that has three first edition iPod Classics, the 5 GB, the 10 GB, and the 20 GB, and they're all in the box. They've never been opened. He'll sell you all three of those for $50,000.
Does he? I mean, what are the odds that he's going to find a buyer? I mean, he can ask whatever price he wants.
Well, pretty good. What was that one? How much did that one sell for last year that you mentioned in this story?
This is the U2 one that you're talking about?
Yeah, there's one that sold for $90,000 at auction.
$90,000
on eBay. Yeah, $90,000.
This is for the U2 version edition of the iPod.
Yep.
But didn't you say the guy with the collection, he had some of those same versions of the iPods, and he's only been offered like several thousand dollars for them?
Right. I mean, it's kind of a buyer beware situation. There is really no blue book value on vintage technology. So as one collector I talked to said, if you want it tomorrow, the price is probably too high. So go ahead, Lander.
Well, the prices for Apple Ones were the same. You know, they were getting more and more valuable for years. You know, I remember doing several stories like in the 90s and the 2000s about Apple One prices, and they were sneaking up from from the low 100,000 six figures to the high six figures. You know, and they were pushing up towards a million. But then I think 2008. The economy collapses. There was one sold, I forget now, but in 2009, 2010, the economy not doing so great, and it had completely collapsed. It was selling for a fraction of what the other ones, what they were commanding before previously.
Well, so, it looks like some of that stuff is starting to go back up.
Right, exactly. Yes. And it's like artwork, right? It still remains though that they're, often, they're very hard to find. They're rare, and the ones in perfect condition, I think, because they are such a part of history, technology history, that they will command, in the future, they will command high prices, I think, for sure. I mean, you can imagine people paying high prices for a mint Sony Walkman, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
In college, I made my living by buying and reselling Nintendo 64 games and Super Nintendo games. And if you had – some of the games were more popular than others, of course. And if you had a game with, like, the box, the manual, for the more popular games, you could sell them for hundreds of dollars, way more than they sold for when they were sold brand new. And, you know, that was then. I mean, even now they're even more expensive. And the older these systems get, the more popular games become more and more rare. And, you know, people play them, they break, what have you. And so the prices just skyrocket on some of this stuff if they were, you know, popular systems and popular games.
Well, I'm surprised by the price of these, though. You know, $90,000 is a hell of a, is a heck of a lot of money.
That's got to be like some sheik in Saudi Arabia paying 90 grand, right? Someone who clearly would rather have the item and doesn't really care about the money. Because 90 grand for a closed U2 edition? Right. iPod. I love you too. I think that's a cool item. But.
Well, Dave, but the popular ones are the special edition ones, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because like the name suggests, they didn't make nearly as many. It was usually kind of a tribute piece for a certain artist. Like you could get a No Doubt or a Beck iPod, and you'd pay a little extra money, but then you like get like their latest album or a collection of their music. There was even a Harry Potter iPod where you could,
really?
In 2005, 2006, you could buy an iPod Classic with the Hogwarts crest on it. And it also came with the audiobooks.
See, I would imagine the ones that actually have a visual change from the original iPods, those are the ones that people would really want. Because the U2 one didn't have a red click wheel and then a black body?
Yeah, like you could get like the Red Hot Chili Peppers iPod and it would have their logo and then the signatures of the different
like laser inscribed
artists.
On the back?
Yes, engraved.
Yep. I didn't even know they made a Chili Peppers iPod.
They do, yeah. Or
they probably
did,
have all sorts of special versions that we've never heard of.
Yeah, how many were there, Dave?
I don't know exactly how many different special edition ones, but they still come out with special edition iPod Touches. Like you can still get a Harry Potter iPod Touch or an iPod Nano. So
wait, what? I gotta go.
No, I'm gonna go buy a right. Hey kids, yeah. You know, like when I kick the bucket, hey, yeah.
Yeah, don't take them out of the box.
Right here. Yeah, exactly.
But one piece of advice I would give to people is to just sort of check out the history of sales on that item you think you have to have. You can go to a site like TerraSpeak and you can pop in the name of the model number of the thing you're looking for, and it'll give you like an eBay history of how well that thing sold. So, you know, $50,000 or $20,000 for an unopened iPod, you know, I don't know if that's a good investment, but you might be able to find somebody who'll sell you one for $2,000.
I know the answer to that question. It's no. It's not a good investment. Absolutely not.
No.
It's totally, it's just completely gambling. Who knows what's going to happen? And once the economy crashes again, it's going to be worth nothing. And you'll be sitting there listening to your iPod crying into your hands. Well, you spent $60,000 on it.
I've got the original. I've got two of the original iPods and also the original iPod box. But I think I cracked them both open to replace the batteries at one point because the batteries were dying out. And
you know, you could still get a pretty good chunk of change for those.
Huh? And they're kind of
you might even be able to sell just the box.
Yeah. Well, that was I still have. Do you remember the original? The bag that the original iPhone came in. Do you remember that was a hot item on eBay at the time?
You mean like when they put the iPhone in the bag at the Apple Store?
Right, and it was
you?
A special sort of gift bag that came that they put your iPhone in.
No, that's hilarious.
That was they were selling for like $500, $1,000 at one time on eBay. They were collectors. Yeah. I still got one of those here.
These are the items that make pack rats everywhere argue with their family members and say, see, I told you saving this bag was going to be a good idea someday.
Well, what I should have kept is all the press packets that they gave out. So, because they had a special U2 one that had a poster in it. and some other stuff.
Yeah, that's probably worth some change.
Well, yeah, because they're really hard to get, and no one kept those. I mean, everyone chucked them out. All the journalists that went to the
right,
the launch,
because you guys were so disinterested in the iPod.
Well, you had no idea. You know, this doesn't seem like anything's going to have any value at all. At, you know, at some point in the future, but
right.
looking back on it,
yeah. Leander, you should read around your desk drawer there and see if there's other things you could maybe put up for sale on eBay.
Well, I cleaned them out years ago, but at one point I did. I, you know, like the, because you'd spike stuff like that, and it would just go like, you know, it would too much effort to throw it away, so I just chuck it under my table, and there's boxes and boxes of things. And I went to all those launches, like that launch where the U2 one was in San Jose at the beautiful old Art Deco Theater they have downtown. I forget the name of it, but you know,
and U2 was there, right?
Yeah, the U2 guys were there. And they were on the stage with Steve, and
Doubt Leander was all that impressed with U2. I bet you were not a big U2 fan, right?
I liked a few songs, but not really. No,
they had some good songs.
Yeah,
Joshua Tree, one of the best albums of all time.
Well,
Rattle and Hum. Oh my gosh, don't even get me started. Okay, well, let's move on. Last segment of the day, the Lust List. Oh yeah, this is the gear or anything really. That you guys really want, you don't yet have, and you just want it so bad. Does anyone want to go first? Leander, what do you got?
Well, I'm ashamed of what I want, and I don't really know, think I want to
even better
reveal it. And it's actually become kind of an obsession. You know, I'm checking Craigslist all the time for it.
Uh-huh.
And my wife saw it the other day, and she was like, oh, my goodness, it set off a storm. So I'm a little reluctant to mention it. But it's, you know, I want an Aston Martin.
You're kidding. What? Wow. That was definitely not what I was expecting you to say.
It's really ridiculous. And it's like a cliche of, you know, where I am in the mid-crisis, you know, car, like having a fast sports car. I'm sick of driving minivans and, you know, kid moving vehicles. I want something fast and sleek and
is there a year and model you want?
Well, you know, I mean, the Vantage is that the higher end ones would be awesome, but I was looking at I was trying to find a more affordable one. And
that sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, well, they drop a ton in price, you know, the older ones. And there was actually one that was about 20 grand, and it was a DB9, I think. Unfortunately, someone painted this hideous racing stripe down the middle. It was like, and it was an ugly color too. It was like burgundy with this hideous yellow stripe down the middle.
Well, that just makes it look faster.
Well, they thought, and had a spoiler.
Who doesn't
on
see
it.
A burgundy race stripe and not think, whoa, really, that thing really moves?
They had really defiled it. I mean, it was crazy because it was like the kind of thing you would do if you had like a Honda or a Accord or something, right? A car that wasn't fast and you wanted to make it look
right.
fast.
And you put one of those giant spoilers
right.
in the back.
And this is exactly what they'd done to this car that actually was genuinely fast. So it was just too much. I really couldn't go for it. But yeah, they do drop a lot in price, but they're still like 50, 70 grand. There's no way Tracy, I would be diced. I would be literally chopped into bits and put in a freezer somewhere. So it's, you know, it's completely and utterly unrealistic, but it's definitely something.
Well, this is why you got to get it without her knowing, because if you get it without her knowing and then you pull up, first she'll be mad that you got it. But once she sees you getting out of that Aston Martin, she's going to be overwhelmed with Eros. Unable to control herself.
I don't think so. If only that were true. If it were true, I would do it, but I don't think it is. No, I think I would literally be, you know, like I'd be the next Bobbit. I'd be on some talk show with some parts missing.
Has your partner sliced off your kibbles and bits? Call now.
Yeah, precisely.
Okay, so Leander wants an Aston Martin. I hope you get one, Leander. I really hope you get one. I want to see a picture of you and your Aston Martin and the Kangol hat.
With your bits on the passenger seat.
Yeah, with your bits in a jar next to you. Worth the tray. All right, David, what do you want?
Well, I'll tell you, my midlife crisis is not nearly as interesting or sexy as Leander's. I really want this new Fujifilm X-Pro2 camera.
Yeah.
I've got the old, clunky, slow-focusing X-Pro1. Fuji's now kind of worked out all the bugs, and they've made this beautiful, retro-looking rangefinder camera. And but, you know, right now I'm at a point where we're closing in on a house. my wife and I, and I can't do anything sudden or drastic while the stuff, while our loan request is before the underwriter. Right. So I'm just going to hold on. But I've got a friend who's switching over to Fuji, and I've been spending his money all week telling him what to buy. So I live vicariously through him. And, you know, $1,600, which is not bad. It's not the...
It's buy it's not, only, though, right?
It is. It's not as expensive as Aston Martin, but...
right. You know. Well, how much do the lenses cost, Dave?
You know, Fuji's really reasonably priced for the lenses. Like, you can get a 35 millimeter f2 for like $399.
So all in, you're looking at a couple of grand.
Yeah, it's not bad
for a DSLR, for a really nice DSLR, and it's compact.
It really is compact. It's light, you know, you don't feel it if you're wearing it around your neck all day or on your shoulder. Yeah, everybody that I know that has that camera is orgasmic when they talk about it.
So, wow.
Yeah.
Let's make for a strange conversation.
Yeah, bits and orgasm. Bits and orgasm, yeah.
Are you okay? Just a second.
Oh, this camera's great.
Don't talk to me. I got the X-T1 recently.
Nice.
And I really like it. I'm not ready to do my full review of it yet, but it is the lightest camera I have ever used, and it's great carrying it around because, you know, a full-on DSLR weighs like 25 pounds once you have the lens on it and everything. So you just never really take it with you anywhere. Well, this thing is under a pound even with the lens, so you actually take it places with you. And I got to say, because the Fuji sensors are unlike the sensors in Nikons or Canons, they designed these sensors themselves. They are some of the sharpest sensors I have ever seen. The pictures I have gotten out of this camera are unbelievably sharp, sharp.
And that's before you put the pictures through Lightroom or Photoshop.
Well, I haven't even really seen a need to do that because the color reproduction has been excellent. So for the first time ever, I have just taken JPEGs out of this camera. And normally I run them through Lightroom. You know, I take the raw image, run it through Lightroom and, you know, adjust a bunch of stuff. And I still like to do that sometimes, but with the Fuji, the pictures come out, and I'm like, there's not really a whole lot I would do to this. So it's good enough for everyday use, you know, especially for, like, family photos, pictures of your pets. You know, just running around, taking pictures of stuff. It really is an impressive camera. There are some things I don't like about it so far.
Yeah, but, it's a little over-designed, and there are some crazy settings that I still haven't figured out on the two Fuji cameras that I have. But, you know, Fuji made great film back in the day, some great slide film, some great negative film, and they have a setting for each of those classic films on the camera.
Hmm.
And, you know, I don't even set it on my camera, but I can take a image that I shoot and run it through their RAW converter, and then I can... you know, preview it in the different film styles and, you know, pick what looks the prettiest.
I haven't played around with that yet, but that was one of the things I was interested in using as well, just kind of seeing how it affects the final image quality and stuff.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up with mine. Mine is actually a DJI Phantom 4 drone. So I have never really had a big interest in drones. I didn't really see the point of them. But I think in a previous Stuff We're Into segments, I talked about Casey Neistat's videos. He does daily vlogs. And he has started using a drone in his to capture like B-roll from the different places where he vlogs from. And I was totally taken aback. He has been able to create these beautiful, sweeping, cinematic shots with this tiny little drone and a 4K camera attached. I mean, it's totally transformed his daily vlogs into, you know, what were entertaining, you know, narrative-based stories into more cinematic, short story-type experiences. It's really improved the quality of his videos a lot. And, you know, $1,400 for a Phantom 4 drone is a lot of money. But to be able to fly one of these things into the air and take cool cinematic scenescapes from the areas in which you live, I think that's pretty gosh darn cool. I don't know what I would use it for, which is, like, is why I haven't bought one. I'm like, what am I going to do with it?
Kids' birthday parties.
Maybe.
Trips to the
I mean, you could put
park.
This thing on follow mode so that when you're going up on like hikes and stuff, it will actually follow you and sweep around you, you know, like in a perimeter action. So you get like images of you going up this hike. And I was like, this would be perfect for bustersnudehikes.com, where he could like create like, you know, promotional YouTube videos and get some amazing quality video from it. I just think it would be cool. Other than that, they have like drone racing mode built in, so it flies super fast. It has obstacle avoidance, so it has like these ultrasonic sensors, so if it gets close to a tree, it will realize that and stop so it doesn't crash into it. I just think drones look super fun. They're like remote control cars, right? They're the ultimate kid's toy.
Although, do not take it to a Renaissance festival. You saw that video this week out of Russia where a guy was flying around a Renaissance festival with his drone, and some guy just chucked a spear at it. And it
I was just going to say, did it get speared?
Yes, and it fell right out of the sky. It was great.
Wow. You know that man laid with many maidens that night after that.
Yep. He slayed the dragon. He did.
He's the ultimate spear chucker. Yeah, he just threw it right up into the sky. That's pretty impressive, really. He just threw it up into the sky and destroyed the drone?
Yep. Yeah, you can go to Laughing Squid and check out that video.
Is it on YouTube? I got to make sure I put that in the show notes.
Spear, drone, right up.
Chucker. Okay, well, we should go ahead and wrap it up there because there's no way I'm going to top a man throwing a spear into a drone in the middle of the sky. That's all the Cultcast we have for you guys this week. If you want to come tell us about your lust list, please do. We're on Twitter. Leander is L. Caney, Buster's BST3R. And you can write your tweets down and mail them to David Pierini. We'll make sure we include his home mailing address in the show notes. This has been the Cultcast, the best 30-plus minute album conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the Cultcast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys
next time.
Hey, good job, man. You nailed it.
I got it right this time. It only took three weeks.
Only took 3 episodes.
Yeah.
You almost said next week.
Yeah.
check. Make sure my mic's the right mic's selected. Okay, let's do a clap on the count of, well, you know how it works. 1, 2, 3. Who was that?
That sounded not on time to me.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, let's try again. 1, 2, 3. That was better.
Really? Oh, that was way up for me.
Really? How was that for you, David?
It was a little delayed.
Okay.
Well, 2 of the 3 were right on.
Yeah, same here. And then 1 was a little bit delayed, which is what I would expect, just because I think probably 1 of us is a little delayed. I don't think it's a computer problem.